Hello, I'm Phoebe.
I'm Clancy.
And I'm Damien.
Now you might be asking, what do an Aussie and a Pom have in common? Quite a lot, actually.
For starters, Her Majesty has her face over all our currency.
There's a great big Union Jack on all our flags as well.
We do speak the same language.
And we do love winding each other up.
Yeah, because you guys can't play cricket.
Well, you guys don't want to play us at cricket. That's the big difference.
Let's get on with the show.
We discuss current events in Australian politics.
While on a mission to ensure the Governor-General stays in their job.
Let's save
the Governor-General.
Do we want to?
Do you want ScoMo as president instead?
Oh, God, no.
There you go. Let's save the Governor-General. Hello, Clancy. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you, Damien. How are yourself?
Oh, living the dream, as they say. And speaking of living the dream, our co-conspirator and partner in crime has not arrived yet. I'm just curious as if she's woken up.
Well, she may not have. She did mention that she was not feeling terribly well, terribly perky.
No, that's it's a bit weird not having the terribly perky Phoebe J. Rose, Queen of the Sauna, in with us.
That's right. So she might be feeling a bit under the UK weather today.
It's very very UK-ish. She might be feeling the humiliation of England being absolutely smashed in the first Ashes test.
Oh, were they?
They were indeed, yes. It was quite a... I think humiliating is the kindest way of putting it.
Okay, I'm afraid it's not something that I've been paying attention to.
No.
The only thing that I was a bit horrified about was that Hobart's been chosen to host the Ashes.
So they're all coming your way.
Yes, unfortunately. I'm wondering if I could stage a coup or...
You can put up do an anti-vax protest or something.
Not an anti-vax protest, an anti-cricket protest.
Well, look, combine the two and see what you get. So, Clancy, thank you for joining. If Phoebe does come in, we'll happily welcome her in, and if she doesn't, then hey, Phoebe, hope you're feeling better. But thank you for joining me for this bit of a mixed episode where there's a couple of current talking points. But one thing that we were going to talk about in our last general discussion episode was the religious discrimination bill.
That's correct.
So, would you want to give your thoughts about that? Since we are both professing atheists, and the only difference between you and me is that you were never bitten by the belief bug.
I was never bitten by the belief bug, and I was never indoctrinated, so I never had an exposure, I guess, to that sort of religious thought and that religious environment that you did.
Yep.
So one thing I was brought up with was a disdain for all religious thought and all religious education and all religious educational institutions.
Okay.
So I'm of the firm belief that all education should be public. And if you want to send your child to a religious school, then you should pay for the whole thing yourself, and that religious schools should not have any influence on anyone else. So that's a fundamental to me. I'm like, anyone can go to a public school, but they should not teach religion at public schools.
Okay.
And they should not have things like chaplains, for instance, which I think are just a complete and utter hypocrisy. Oh, totally.
I think anachronistic is the best word because,
I agree with you.
I think back when we were in school, chaplains were seen as maybe a necessary evil, but now in this post-religious society, why is a representative of one religion being given exclusive access to the kids?
Exactly. And when I was at school, which was probably slightly before you were at school, we didn't actually have chaplains at the school I went to, but we did have scripture classes.
Okay, yeah.
And we used to have to present a note from our parents to excuse us from scripture.
Okay.
So I would do basically a couple of times my mum said my mum forgot to give me the note. So this, the beginning of the year, I would go along to the scripture classes. And, you know, as a 6, 7, 8 year old, I was fairly clued up about stuff. And so I would challenge whoever taught the scripture classes about the veracity of their claims.
Yep.
And would pretty much guarantee that I got kicked out within the first or second class and had to go and sit in the library anyway, which was fine by me because I much prefer reading a book. But the funny thing about it was that it meant that I actually got exposed to a couple of different religions because we had we had not only the run-of-the-mill Church of England, we had the Catholics, and we also had some Jewish students.
Okay.
So I got to sit in on a few different ones, which was quite fun.
Nice. So the first question is, why do we have this bill in front of us? Do you want to go over a little bit of the history as to why it's come in the first place?
So basically the current government in Australia, the Liberal National Party, which is a coalition for those people who don't know, have at their heart the main members of cabinet and of the government are fundamentalist Christians of one ilk or another.
Now, I will say that in Australia, the Liberal Party, which is the Conservative or maybe the equivalent of either the Republican Party or the Tories in England.
The Tories, yes.
So the Liberals are more seen as the party for the evangelicals to vote for.
That's correct.
And whereas in my understanding, the Labour Party is more for the Catholics.
I think that used to be true.
Okay, all right.
I think that used to be true, but Labor in general, and I'm saying in general, has made a concerted move away from that sort of perception.
No, fair. So basically,
The reason they were seen as being more Catholic was because of the unions and because of that Labor movement focus, because most of the people that ran the unions were Irish
indeed.
Catholic.
Who just happened to be Catholic. So basically, because we have a government who is led by a Hillsong Conservative.
That's correct, yeah.
Continue on, please, Clancy.
So my perception of events, which, you know, you may disagree with, is that we have this government that's mostly run by, evangelical fundamentalist-type Christians. And there's a perception at the moment that because Christianity and a general belief in Christianity and a general adherence to Christianity is waning, that therefore equates to Christians somehow being persecuted. I don't think this is true. I think that they're justifiably being pushed to the side, which is not the same as being persecuted. They are losing their following because they're fundamentalist Christians, and most Australians are starting to realise that
We can do without it.
Yeah. And also we do have a multicultural society, and there are a lot of people in Australia who are adhering to other faiths apart from Christianity if they aren't atheists. But we also have a growing majority of atheists. Or people who don't adhere to a particular religious belief.
So I'm just reading this from theconversation.com. Why do we have this bill? When same-sex marriage was legalized in late 2017, conservative religious groups were promised a religious freedom review as a consolation prize. That review, led by former Liberal MP Philip Ruddock, there's a name I haven't heard for a while, found Australia does not have a religious freedom problem, but did recommend new legislative protections against religious discrimination. In response, in December 2018, the Morrison government promised a Religious Discrimination Act. Former Attorney General Christian Porter released a draft religious discrimination bill in late 2019 and a second draft in early 2020. And now it's come to a third draft, which has been pushed by current Attorney General Michaela Cash. So basically what the idea is that it protects statements of belief.
That's correct, yeah. So I think the idea behind it is that Christianity, evangelical Christians, fundamental Christians are actually becoming a minority in Australia. Mm-hmm. And this is terrifying them because they don't actually have that power of numbers anymore. And mm-hmm. the main people that vote for them are people who are probably religious.
Mm-hmm.
So they see that their influence is waning, and they're seeing this as I said to you before, as a type of persecution. Now, yeah, it's not persecution. It just means that people are sick of them, quite rightfully. Yeah. But yeah. It's been interesting to me to sort of follow this progression, because the fact that people are pushing back, they are seeing as being persecution.
Mm-hmm.
Right? We don't want you in our schools. We don't want you in our homes. We don't want people to tell us what we're meant to believe. We don't want the government saying a bloody oath at the start of parliamentary question time. Like, seriously. So, you know, so there's the part of the problem is that they are talking about their right to express their religious views.
Mm-hmm.
What about the right of the rest of us to not have their religious views imposed upon us?
I think that might be something that's been overlooked. And it does seem to be a lot of the debate has focused around the Christian side of the equation.
Mm-hmm.
And there doesn't seem to be much discussion about the Muslim or the Hindu or even the Scientology
side of the
equation. So, which kind of gives the impression that Prime Minister Morrison is more building this to curry favour with the Christian groups, but in particular the more fundamentalist Christian groups.
Exactly.
So
right.
Now I think that there is a name that we do need to briefly discuss that also ties into this. And that name is Israel Folau.
Aha, yes,
The Folau Clause, yes. So just to go back over a little bit of history, now I forget exactly which year it was, it might have been 2015 or 2016. So Israel Folau, a multi-football code player, who's also a very conservative, now I think he's actually a Jehovah's Witness. If not mistaken, I think he's either a Mormon or a Jehovah's Witness or a Seventh-day Adventist. He's one of these more fringe, he's one of these fringe Christians. And so he posted on one of his social media accounts that basically homosexuals are going to hell. Like homosexuals and atheists and all these other people with these characteristics are in danger of the fires of hell, repent and be saved. Something like that. So that then got his ARU contract. It was actually the Australian Rugby Union.
Mm.
It got his ARU contract torn up. And so then him and the Australian Rugby Union people went to court. I think there was eventually a settlement. So firstly, the first time he did it, he was warned not to post anything more. Then he did it again, and it became this big kerfuffle about, sure, he's allowed his right to express his religious belief, but also as a person earning millions of dollars, he is also seen as a role model, and then also the ARU have non-discriminatory stances and all this kind of stuff. So in a way, this whole persecution complex goes back to, well, at least that. So in a way, there's a case that could be made that Scott Morrison and the Conservative government are trying to undo that kind of damage. So
that's correct. I just did a quick search on Israel. So it was 2019 it really blew up, but it was
okay.
It was based on all the gay marriage debate.
Oh, that's right, and yes, yep.
The plebiscite. So he basically voiced some opinions on public media about how he didn't believe that homosexuals should get married, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this is sort of part of the point of it, is that I think the Christians are actually feeling that they've been persecuted because they've been expressing views against things like homosexuality and gay marriage and abortion and a bunch of other things that are based on their religious beliefs.
Yes.
So this idea that they should have the right to express those beliefs and that that's a freedom thing actually impinges on a bunch of other rights about...
I think part of that was a kickback against that whole idea that Christians were expressing beliefs that was basically going against what, was being defined as hate speech.
Mm-hmm.
And so there was flashback against them for doing that. And they felt that they should have the right to express those beliefs because that was part of their religion.
Well, their religion entitles them to say things that, you know, a more advanced and more progressive society wouldn't welcome.
Wouldn't welcome, exactly. No. Right. So I think the interesting thing about it too is that we don't actually have a right to free speech in Australia. There is not anything in our constitution that says that we have a right to free speech. So they have to instead put in a right to a type of speech, I guess, or to have a justification for expressing certain views. And this is how they're getting around it. But you still can't express hateful views. This is the thing. You still can't discriminate against people currently on the basis of their faith, their religion, their sexuality, their gender.
Whole range of protected characteristics. Yes.
Exactly, race, all those sorts of things.
So,
but they want to discriminate against people on the basis of their religion by saying that they should only be able, they should be able to only hire teachers in schools, for instance, that are religious based.
Yep.
Who follow the faith of that school and who don't engage in behaviours.
But yes, there's one particular type of behaviour that they're very much against.
That they feel are against their religious belief.
Mm-hmm.
So they are discriminating against people on the basis of their lack of belief or a different belief.
Yeah.
So, and they're just trying to justify it.
Yeah, it's a tricky one because... Yeah, for me, from my perspective, it's a tricky one because I agree with the right of people to hire people who they think will add to the culture of a workplace,
mm-hmm.
but you can't do that. Well, I say you shouldn't be able to do that at the expense of other things. It's a bit of a tricky balance. But I think the way the states have got it is with the anti-discrimination. Actually, that's probably one thing we should mention is that the federal discrimination bill will actually override, will try to override the state's anti-discrimination bills.
Right. Yeah.
So we're kind of like Scott Morrison's trying to create this argy-bargy between the federal government and the state government. So let's say I apply for a job at a Christian school or even a Muslim school. as an atheist, and I get kicked back. Who do I go to? Do I go to the state government? Do I go to the federal government? So all this kind of one more present from Scotty for the general public.
I mean, I find it's interesting in a way because I find it almost a moot point because I don't really understand personally why anybody who wasn't a Christian, who was homosexual or an atheist or a Muslim, would want to work in an environment like that in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
But then I also don't understand why people get married, and I still support the right of homosexuals to get married, even though I don't understand why they would bother, because I don't want to get married as a heterosexual woman. I have no interest in the whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
But I also support the right of women to join the military and to go into battle with them. And I'm a pacifist, and I don't believe that we should have a standing army. You know, I also believe in the right of women to be praised if they want to. And I'm an atheist, so I don't understand why they would want to be praised. But I still believe that they have that right to do that if that's what they want to do it, if they are actually capable of doing that.
Yeah, there's a big...
This is part of the argument. But so why you would want to go and teach at a school like that, I don't know. But I can imagine there would be some circumstances. Maybe it's the only school in your town.
Yep, exactly.
You know, so there might be other reasons why people want to. And, you know, some of these schools do run really good programs along certain lines. But
exactly.
That's why they want to teach at those schools. But it's a little bit like, you know, for me, I'm a nurse. I would never, ever work in a religious-run private hospital. I just wouldn't do it because I just don't agree with the ethos.
Okay.
But if it's the only hospital in my town...
And you need a
job. I'm forced to. Yeah. And if they're going to try and say that they're not going to hire me because I'm an atheist...
Yep.
You know... Yeah, but the interesting, I mean, the other interesting thing about this is I think that there's actually quite a lot of scope for people to bite back against this bill, because it's going to be pretty easy for teachers who don't agree with it just to boycott the schools.
Yeah, like, vote with their feet.
Vote with their feet. Mm-hmm. And that goes for the same for the parents who send their children to those schools. Like. Yeah. Do you really want to send your child to a school that would discriminate against people based on their religious beliefs? Lack thereof.
Yeah, it's a very, very, you raise some very good points there, Clancy. It's, you know, why would you? But then sometimes you don't have choice, but sometimes you need to go where you think the best education opportunity for your kids are, or the best employment. It's all this...
It's particularly true in Tasmania, actually. There's an interesting situation in Tasmania that I didn't even realise until I moved here.
Yeah.
Is that most of the schools in Tasmania, the high schools, only go to year 10.
Okay. And then?
So then if your child wants to finish their education and get their higher schooling certificate, I think it's the GCSE in Victoria, isn't it?
VCE.
HSC in New South Wales.
Yep.
So basically if your child wants to do that and then go on to university or whatever, they have to go to college. It's a senior college system.
Yep.
But of course the best colleges are private, religious ones.
Mm.
And you have to pay for them.
Yeah, and because pay through Tasmania... The
And Tasmania is, you know, it's actually got a very small population. There's only just under or just over 500,000 people living in the whole of Tassie.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot of areas where it's quite sparse. So, for instance, I lived on the West Coast for a period of time, which is mostly old mining towns.
Yeah, yep.
And there's only a population of about 5,000 people who live on the West Coast. So
All up.
Yeah, really? So I lived in a town that had less than 700 people when I was living there.
Oh, jeez.
So, and the regions are quite, like, you know, the population can be quite spread out. So they basically just had, they had primary schools that were public schools, but they had one high school at Queenstown and they didn't go to year 12. So they had to send their kids away. So... You know, and the quality of the schools as well, the quality of the public schools was considered to be lesser than the quality of the private schools. And that was basically due to deliberate funding by the government, who gave preference and funded the private schools.
The private religious schools.
Private religious schools, right.
Yeah.
So a lot of parents actually don't feel that they have a choice, that if they want their child to get a decent education, that they have to pay for it, and they have to pay for it in a religious
context. Yeah.
So this sort of bill would actually affect Tasmania really quite badly, whereas, you know, I grew up in New South Wales.
Yeah.
My high school, you know, was a massive great big, I mean, the population, the number of students in my high school was equivalent to the population of the town on the West Coast where I live.
Yeah, yeah.
And we went all the way through to year 12. So, and most high schools in Sydney did. The funny thing about that, though, is that school that I went to is our college.
a religiously run
not
college.
A religious college.
Like, okay, all right, that's...
But you know, so this is part of the thing, is it's going to disproportionately affect parts of the country more than others. And Tasmania in particular, and probably a lot of other regional areas where the dominant educational institution is going to be a religious institution. Mm. And it's going to affect a lot of kids who live in rural areas where the parents have to send them to boarding schools, because most boarding schools are going to be private religious-run institutions. So this is going to be part of the problem, is even if you've got parents who are not religious themselves and don't necessarily agree with having their child indoctrinated into religion, still feel like they don't have choice but to send their kids to one of these schools to get a good education. And I'm not arguing about the quality of the education, because often these sorts of schools do attract really good teachers who teach you know, really well, and there's a high standard in those schools. But that's also because most of the parents are well off anyway, so there's already a bias because they probably read to their children when they were young.
It's there's a whole lot of different factors involved.
Oh, there's so many different factors, exactly. But and of course, you know, you also have a lot of poorer kids who might get scholarships, who might be from disadvantaged backgrounds.
Yep.
For various reasons, a lot of migrant children, Aboriginal kids, you know, routinely from rural areas will get some sort of scholarships to go to these sorts of schools as well. So it, you know, it affects a range of things, not just the right of the school to hire and fire people that they don't consider to be part of their ethos.
It's like religious schools do provide, particularly out our way, two of the three of the best schools in my area are schools that are closely tied to a church. So there's a school in my area that's tied to a Baptist church, and they're seen as one of the best in the area. There's another one that's run by the Anglican church, and they're seen as one of the best in the area. There's also an Islamic college as well, which is and the funny thing is that the Islamic college is literally across the road from the school run by the Anglican church. We're all happy bedfellows out in Melbourne.
But I mean, and that's the thing too, is that I the quality of the teachers is not determined by their religious belief or their lack of religious belief.
Indeed.
Some of, you know,
or even their sexuality.
And that's a really good point. Some of my best teachers when I was in high school were out and out, you know, raging gay
homosexuals.
Yeah.
Yep.
So, you know, my favorite high school teacher was my English teacher who Rory. Mm-hmm. And he was awesome. He was amazing. He was one of my favorite teachers ever. He used to do things like asking us to write essays and what on the air inside a ping pong ball, you know, things like that.
That's
it's brilliant. So, but that's the thing, is like part of it, I think, is around influence, and teachers particularly influence their students in a variety of ways. And one of the ways they influence their students is by their own presentation and their own self. So if you have a gay teacher, most students who have a gay teacher are going to go, oh, okay, this is just a normal part of life. And they'll, you know, so I think part of this thought may actually be trying to remove those influences from those kids so that they don't normalize things like that.
Well, I hope you're wrong in that aspect, but there's
a bit 1984-ish.
Yeah, there's part of me that says you may not be wrong, but yeah, I think the biggest problem I have with the religious discrimination bill is that it gives one class of people the right to discriminate against another class of people.
Yes, and the other class of people no right to actually fight back.
Yeah, or if they do fight back, then they're seen as the bad guys, and it's I think what we need as society is to move away from discrimination and I think this legislation does the opposite of it.
That's
so
exactly right.
It's but the next thing I wanted to discuss, and this is something Phoebe wanted to discuss, was the Jenkins report that came out I think a couple of weeks ago. So what? When was it? Don't remember exactly when it was. No, it was in the last couple of weeks. Sex Discrimination Commissioner Kate Jenkins presented a review to the Parliament about the workplace culture of Parliament, especially towards women. What was it? Calls for mandatory training for politicians and staff on appropriate workplace behaviour. Sweeping recommendations of a damning report into sexual harassment in Parliament. And Chelsea Potter, a former Liberal staffer, made mention of a culture of violent misogyny. The review was overwhelming in terms of accuracy of the culture that is reflected in terms of my own experience. So,
well, I mean, this actually ties back into our last podcast where we were talking about, well, not the last one, because it was the one before, when we were talking about the misogyny speech.
Yes, the Julie Gillard, yes.
And the experience of women in politics, and my own experience, and one of the reasons I never actually entered politics. And it does have a lot to do with the culture.
Yes.
Of politics, and of the Parliament in particular.
Indeed.
And of course, traditionally that culture has been a very male-dominated culture.
Yep.
That has traditionally excluded women, or demoted them to lower responsibility type roles.
Indeed. Now, in a former life, I was considering standing for Parliament in my younger, more conservative days. And but one thing that turned me against was the blood sport that politics can become.
Absolutely.
And that's even for men. And even for women, you know, it's just one of those things that unfortunately there does seem to be a thing where women are sexualized, or they're the subject of sexual comments. They're seen as inferior members if they take time off for their family, or if they fall pregnant, or something like that. And so that blood sport aspect is turned up towards women. And these are the actual politicians. Then we get down to the staffers, and the support staff, and the chiefs of staff, and all that kind of stuff.
Yep, that's correct. And I mean, it's even as fundamental as over sexualizing women who work in those roles, and concentrating on the fact that they're women rather than the role that they actually play and the work actually do. I mean, one of the things that disgusted me, I don't know if you remember, all the stuff with Tony Abbott's staffer.
Peter Credlin.
Peter Credlin.
Yes.
Now, I'm not particularly a fan of Peter Credlin, but I was pretty disgusted about how she was being portrayed, not just by the media, but by other members of the Parliament. And most of it was talking about the fact that she was a woman, and that she was working for Tony Abbott, and that she was doing all these nasty female things, but not actually talking about what her actual job was, you know, and what why she was doing it and how she was doing it. So I don't agree with her, but I don't agree with how she was portrayed either. And
no.
And that happens a lot. It's that portrayal of women as somehow being subservient to men, even when they're technically their bosses.
Yeah, and I do remember around that time as well, there were numerous rumours flying around that Peter Credlin and Tony Abbott were having an affair.
Yes, and that's partly what I'm referencing.
Okay,
and that was
yeah.
the only way she'd gotten the job was that, you know, because they were sleeping together.
Yeah,
and that's that sort of perception too, that, you know, a woman working in a man's world somehow can only get ahead if she's also sleeping.
Or she's a complete ball-breaking bitch.
So is that, there's that sort of undercurrent, I guess,
yep,
that goes into that. And that doesn't just include, you know, the people in Parliament. That's talking about the staffers.
Exactly, exactly. And like as much exposure is on the politicians themselves, it's the staffers and the undercurrent, the behind the scenes stuff that really where the heat really should be applied. But so hopefully with this particular report, hopefully things will become better. And I think this is actually going to tie into the end of year brief wrap up that we did, because one of the things that I did want to discuss was the Brittany Higgins affair.
Yes.
Yeah. As well, and this...
Well, I mean, that's pretty much what kicked off this whole thing anyway, wasn't
indeed,
it?
Indeed, yes.
Yeah, so, I mean, yes, that sort of thing, like even when I was a member of the party, it never happened to me because I was never actually in a position for that to occur. But I witnessed some of it, which was one of the reasons I didn't. And you could see it all around you. You know, I mean, it was almost taken for granted that that was going to happen, and that if you were a woman and you wanted to work in Parliament in whatever capacity, you just had to suck it up. It was a real perception.
Yeah, that's
amongst everybody. And in fact, it was almost seen as a rite of passage that it proved that you were more fit for the job if you could actually
handle all the shit that flies your way.
Exactly right. So it was almost like, it was almost seen like running the gauntlet in the military or something like that.
Yeah.
You had to endure a hazing to actually prove that you were made of the right stuff.
Yep.
You know?
And speaking of which, there is currently a Royal Commission into mental health of returned soldiers.
Yes.
And a lot of it is in response to the hazing that soldiers give young recruits.
Exactly.
I think the old word for it was bastardization.
That's it, yes.
Where...
So there was definitely a culture of that that I witnessed, you know, as a young woman, you know, 20 or 25 years ago.
Yep.
And that's persisted. And if you talk to women who've worked in Parliament, even MPs who've been in Parliament for a long time, I mean, there's stories that you hear about things that had happened to them or things that they witnessed.
Yep.
And in the bad old days, that was just taken for granted, and you just shut up and put up with it and kept on with your job and hope that you would get promoted out of a situation or something like that, you know, or taken on by another member of Parliament who wouldn't do that, or where the culture was better. So I think, you know, that was definitely always part of that system, and it has to change. Like it has to change. You know, there's just no way that sort of behaviour is sustainable in modern society.
No, especially if the people that we pay to work for us and make decisions are too busy in fighting and being jerks and you know, all that kind of stuff, then it's not really representing the community.
That's right. And it's also part of this boys' club perception that a lot of people have of government too.
Mm.
And the, you know, the behaviours that politicians particularly, but other people in Parliament engaged in, that seems to be normalised in Parliament, that would be, everyone would be horrified if you engaged in that sort of behaviour in a corporate situation. The drinking stuff. Like, you can drink alcohol in Parliament, you know. People used to turn up routinely after a boozy lunch to question time and pass out in the Parliament. You know, that used to happen. I'm pretty sure it probably still does, but I think didn't Tony Abbott nod off one time? But there were, the drunken parties and people jumping up on coffee tables and things like that.
Yeah,
and that all contributed to that sexual culture as well, that boys' club culture that they felt that they could get away with behaviour that wasn't okay anywhere else or in any other context. Yeah, yep.
And the woman had to be one of the boys in order to, hang on to their job, almost.
That's right. Which and, is, but this is the thing, too, is that the Labor Party, even though I'm not saying they don't still engage in that culture, they may very well do that, they did recognise this a few years ago. It was one of the reasons I was one of those people trying, because I recognised that the only way to change the culture was to bring more women into the culture to moderate the behaviour of the men so that we could get more women into parliament. So it was like it's just almost this weird sort of, dichotomy that, to get more women into parliament, we need more women in parliament.
It's the second one.
It's the second one.
I know my boy sent me a couple of things, and I'm just briefly.
Okay.
No, all good.
But yeah, so it just I find that sort of thing really interesting, and the fact that men they can work in an environment like that, they can talk the talk about women's rights and treating women appropriately, treating anyone appropriately, in whatever context. And still engage in those behaviours.
This is lip service.
It's lip service, and that's the thing. And I can't remember if it was Kate Jenkins herself, but there was an interview with somebody anyway.
Yeah. Describing
that sort of behaviour and saying that she herself had been engaging in some things that later on they didn't sit well with her at the time, but later on she was like, why did I do that or why did I say it?
Yep. And I said this in a way ties back to the first part. It ties back into religion in that religion can also be a bit of a boys' club as well. In that, now, I don't know if you've ever heard of the podcast The Rise and Fall of Mars Hill. That was about a church in America, so called Mars Hill, and it was run by a gentleman named Mark Driscoll. And his sex advice for women was quite crude, in that he was of the belief that women should make an effort to be overly sexual for their husbands, stuff like that. But the pastor also had like a very thin skin. And basically, they interviewed his former PA, and she reports that she went to a dinner party and she was asked, what's it like working for Mark Driscoll? And she said something very nuanced in that, he's a great motivator, though he does tend to fly off the handle a little bit. And basically within a fortnight, she was hounded out of her job. Because, the word had got back to Mark Driscoll, and then he had launched this demonization campaign against her. And then, he had announced to the congregation on a Sunday that this PA had taken, has decided to resign, when she actually really hadn't. She'd been forced out. So in a way, the way women are treated in politics has a lot of analogues with how women are treated in religious environments as well.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. And I mean, that also speaks a lot to, the position of women in the church as well, and that sort of traditional view.
In that they're administrators rather than... they're administrators rather than teachers, and like the highest that they'll get is like maybe the Sunday school administrator.
Deacons, I think, isn't it?
It depends what denomination you're talking about, but in my fundamentalist charismatic, I do remember in my fundy charismatic church, there was one regional church that they couldn't find someone to pastor, so they had to pray to get special dispensation from God to allow this eminently qualified woman to take over that particular role.
Yeah.
I just found it very, very, it's like, at the time we thought, hey, yeah, God is really moving. God is really cool. God really loves people because he's allowed a woman to be a pastor. Then thinking about it, 20 years later, it's like, hold on, why do you need to pray to God so that a woman can hold a leadership position, I don't quite get. But
well, I mean, doesn't it come down to that fundamental command in the Bible that men should always be dominant over women, or
yes,
be the teacher of women, and women should remain silent?
Women must remain silent in church. If she has any questions, she must ask her husband at home.
There you go.
And so, I do not permit a woman to speak in church.
That's it. So you know, you can't exactly have a woman priest if they're not allowed to talk.
As we touched on before, the Britney rape allegations. Basically, who knew, how much did they know, and when did they know it?
Well, that's an interesting one. I mean, a lot of that stuff that's come out about what happened the night. Like, so, I mean, she was in the office, and she was
security guard. No, she was in the office.
Security guard knew she was in the office, and they obviously knew that she wasn't really in a fit state.
Mm-hmm.
But they didn't actually do anything to help her, and you know, and then it was sort of all hush hush, swept under the carpet. Let's not talk about.
Well, and then when it got to her employer, who was the minister, I think Maurice Payne, who was the minister at the time, and then there was questions about what she knew, and then questions.
Maurice Payne, I thought it was another female minister.
Oh, I forget it. Okay, no, you may be right. Just I know Maurice Payne rings a bell, but then the question is how much does the Prime Minister know as well, and what do they do? And then probably one of the more worrying aspects, or aside from the whole sexual assault thing, is the fact that the boyfriend of Brittany Higgins has had some career blowback as well, because, you know, how dare a woman, you know, rail against the boys' club.
Yes.
Kind of thing. So that's, kind of worrying. The next is the COVID vaccine rollout. The federal government took quite a bit of flack for the delayed rollout.
Well, they did. That was partly because they were trying to buddy their toast on both sides.
I know. That's...
And I mean, look, without having directly been working in public health at the time and being privy to how those things were being decided at the time, I can't comment that much on it. But I can imagine that there was a number of public health experts advising the Prime Minister and the COVID task force on the best ways to achieve the vaccine rollout, and which vaccines probably should have been.
Yep. And I think there was a time when they enlisted the military to help out.
Yes, but part of it was because I think they were hoping that we could have our own homegrown vaccine.
Okay, in Australia. Yep.
So that I think that was part of it, and there was actually a lot of good reasons behind that. Mm-hmm. So, for instance, we were developing one of the mRNA vaccines. Mm-hmm. I think it was through the University of Queensland.
That sounds about right. Yes.
That was showing a lot of early promise, and so I think the idea was that we would be able to do to actually create that ourselves, and therefore not having to go into debt to buy millions of dollars worth of doses from overseas that we might not get in time. Because the main issue always with the COVID Comirnaty vaccine is that it has to be kept very, very cold.
Yes, that was one of the challenges.
So it has to be stored at minus 70 degrees. So you actually need fairly specific vaccine fridges and monitoring, and the cold chain is a fairly intensive process, I guess, which is complicated by shipping and by, you know, transport. And of course, during COVID, that was the one thing that we weren't getting, because no one was going anywhere. And so, you know, routes of transport were effectively closed. So it was a lot more expensive and a lot harder to actually get those vaccines here.
Yep.
So I think that's what the government initially was hoping, was that the other vaccines that were going to be developed in Australia would negate
yep.
to get that.
But
so I think there was some misplaced advice, I guess, and, mm-hmm. and there was some lack of foresight about the fact that, you know, shit happens. And unfortunately, that vaccine didn't pan out because of the issues they had with the vaccine itself creating false positives for HIV.
Yes, that was a...
Yeah.
But just the fact that you say that, I do have some anti-vax friends, and one of the main talking points that they do is, oh, the vaccines are untested and untried. And then yeah. I always come back and say, well, do you realise that the government actually stopped the rollout of this particular vaccine because they found this particular problem in testing?
That's exactly right. But there's also a lack of knowledge and understanding about how vaccines work.
Yep.
Norman Swan made a really good point. I was listening to his podcast.
Mm-hmm.
He actually made a really good point that actually we've been studying and testing vaccines for over 70 years, right? So the processes for developing and testing vaccines is actually very well understood and very yes. well used.
Yep.
The only difference with this vaccine, it's not the vaccine itself that's an issue, it's the disease, because the disease is still not well understood.
Mm.
So most of the diseases that we vaccinate for at the moment have been literally around for thousands of years.
Yes.
So they know them inside and out, and they understand how the disease works. The issue with a vaccine is when you develop a vaccine for a disease, you have some commonalities where you understand that certain things create certain sets of illnesses and certain side effects and things like that.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
If you don't actually understand that the disease is creating these, it's very hard to predict whether or not the vaccine will as well.
Mm-hmm.
So I did actually read a really interesting paper recently, and they were talking about the problems they had with the AstraZeneca vaccine.
Mm-hmm.
So the AstraZeneca vaccine was actually created with the traditional method of making vaccines. So the vaccines that we would traditionally get for things like the flu and measles and all those sorts of things, where they grow it in a medium, they use a medium to grow, and then they deactivate the actual virus. So the virus is not causing any health effects,
mm-hmm.
but your body recognizes the proteins that make up the virus.
Yep.
And that's what creates the antibodies. And so if you become exposed to that virus, those particular proteins are what your immune system is actually reacting against. Part of that immune reaction is what makes you sick. And this is the thing that people don't really understand either, is that when you get the flu, most of the symptoms of the flu, things like your headache and your snotty nose and your temperature and your body aches and pains, are not actually directly
yep.
caused by the virus. They're actually caused by your immune system trying to kill the virus. So one of the things with the traditional method was that they didn't really know what proteins were causing what reactions as well. And they found out, they've actually tracked down that the protein that's responsible for most of the issues that people get with the disease, the actual COVID disease, is it's an inflammatory process that causes a particular type of platelet factor to be activated. They've called it platelet factor 4. And that what happens is that when you get the COVID actual disease,
mm-hmm.
this platelet factor 4 suddenly activates and it aggregates platelets. And that's why we're getting all these people getting blood clots, because all the platelets are clumping together.
Okay.
These blood clots, right?
This is an interesting biology lesson.
Yeah. So this is the reason why people were getting heart attacks and strokes and
yep.
pericarditis and, you know, all these sort of issues.
Yeah.
So they discovered this, and then they realised that the same protein was the main one that was being used in AstraZeneca vaccine. Okay. So this was the protein that the immune system has been reacting to. So they were treating it the same way they would as if the COVID was in the body.
Yep.
Okay. So this, and this is why you're getting this very small proportion of people who obviously have this gene that switches on for this platelet factor 4 are reacting to the AstraZeneca vaccine. And they're getting blood clots
and weird, weird.
So now they've actually worked that out. Yeah, and it's not present in the mRNA vaccines because they don't rely on proteins. They do it in a slightly different way.
They do, yes.
Yes. So that's why they're not getting the same risk factors with the Comirnaty Pfizer vaccine and the new Moderna vaccine.
Okay, well, I've been double Pfizer, so
I'm double Pfizer as well. Yeah. So this is part of the issue, and there may be some other factors to do with how mature your immune system is too, because they find that the side effects drop off as you get older. So it's mostly younger people that was affecting, which is why you couldn't have the AstraZeneca
under a certain age. Yes.
So they think that's something to do with the reactivity of the immune system and the production of this protein. So now they've recognised this. They actually know how to deal with it. So they can actually hopefully get rid of this issue with the AstraZeneca vaccine.
Indeed. And we get to a point where we can at least live with the virus, if not completely wipe it out.
That's right. And the other issue, of course, is we don't know what the long-term effects of the virus itself is going to have. We're already talking about long COVID. And the virus has been around for only less than 2 years. So it's like people have got long COVID. You know, how long is long COVID going to last? You know, and what other things might it cause down the track? And this is the other issue, is a lot of people don't even realise that a lot of other diseases that we vaccinate for have very similar types of profiles. So I don't know if you know this, but measles, for instance, causes something called pansclerosing encephalitis. Have you ever heard of that?
No. I feel I should get my notepad out and listen to this biology lesson.
So measles, before they vaccinated for it, did actually kill quite a lot of children. All right.
Yes,
so
I understand that.
Yes. But it also causes disability. So it used to cause deafness, it used to cause meningitis, pneumonia. And kids often had congenital issues. If you were a pregnant mother and you contracted measles while your baby was in utero, often it caused abortions and your baby would be born with profound disabilities, physical and mental.
Yep.
So there was lots of things that measles actually caused just from getting the disease itself. But one of the other things that it causes, so often a child would get a measles infection. And if it followed the normal course of the disease and they didn't have too many ill effects during the disease, they'd have a couple of weeks where they were pretty unhappy, they had a rash, they had a fever, they were pretty miserable, and then it went away. Right? And so everything, the kid went back to normal, there was no other problems. Until about 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 years later, and suddenly the child would start to develop weird symptoms and fall over all the time and forget things and slur their words and all these odd things started to happen. So it actually turns out that measles can hide away in the brain a little bit like chickenpox does with that other thing that it causes. My brain's just not working. Maybe I've got it. And it basically causes the proteins in the brain to disintegrate. So pansclerosing encephalitis. Inflammation of the brain, it actually destroys the brain tissue. And it is invariably fatal. There is not a cure for it. So you had all these kids who otherwise had been normal, who'd survived measles, suddenly dying from this pansclerosing encephalitis. You don't get it with a vaccine.
Thank God for that.
Okay, so exactly. So it's only kids who have natural measles infections that develop this. So And this is the thing, you know, I've spent years talking to parents who are worried about vaccinating their kids and worrying about the side effects of the vaccine and worrying about all these other things, and somehow thinking that the kid getting a natural infection is safer.
Yep.
But they don't remember all this stuff happening because vaccines have been so effective.
Yes, this is the they're so successful that we've forgotten how bad the original disease was.
Yeah, so parents do not remember it, and even some grandparents don't remember it. Mm. And so, you know, a lot of these sort of things that it's in the bad old past and that doesn't happen anymore. But the problem is if we all stopped vaccinating, it would come back.
Yep. And we've seen that in certain pockets of the world.
Absolutely.
I forget exactly where. I think I was reading something about, like, in Michigan in the United States, where there's a particular section where there's a large anti-vax population. I think there's a high proportion of African migrants there who just haven't been vaccinated, and I think either polio or measles was making a comeback in that area because people weren't vaccinated.
That's correct.
So
yeah.
It's interesting.
A lot of other diseases that they think of as being mild, but actually can cause lifelong problems. So mumps is a good example of that. So mumps.
Rubella. There's a tetanus.
Mild childhood disease until your son tries to go and have a family of his own, discovers he's completely infertile because he had mumps as a kid.
Mm.
So, you know, there's a lot of misinformation, misunderstanding about why we vaccinate against these diseases. That's the thing. It's like there is very good public health reasons why these vaccines were developed in the first place.
Indeed.
And people who are anti-vax actually need to have a look at the history of what these diseases actually did beyond just causing death too. That's the thing, is a lot of people don't think of the other things that
the consequences
before, the consequences. Yes. And yep. a lot of you know, there was institutions full of children who were brain damaged from having infections as children.
Yep That's, you know, yeah. If we don't learn from the past, we are doomed to repeat it.
Exactly right.
So, the political speech of the year by our old friend, by Phoebe's old friend, Boris Johnson, Mr. Mophead, talking about how politicians really should go to Peppa Pig World.
Yeah, I went as we all must to Peppa Pig World. I don't know if you've been to Peppa Pig World. Who's been to Pads? I've been to Peppa Pig World.
That would never get old.
Not enough. I was a bit hazy what I would find at Peppa Pig World, but I loved it. And Peppa Pig World is very much my kind of place. It has very safe streets.
So I don't know if you know that, Clancy, but Peppa Pig World has very safe streets.
Yeah, well, you know, considering the whole population of children, you'd think so.
Maybe we need Peppa Pig for Prime Minister.
In history's page, let everyone...